We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning and welcome to Monday, June 3rd. And I just got a notification on my phone that we are apparently streaming live on X with our American Family Radio Network, which is great. I stream on X as well with my Salem TV show and the podcast. So this is great. If you, like me, are slightly too addicted to X and get your news mostly off of social media and commentary and some of those things that, you know, just give me some interesting topics to talk about and to discuss. And I like to see what the people that I curate and content that I follow, which is across the spectrum, because I want to know what the views are from the far left to the far right, and then compare and contrast that, of course, with truth and the biblical worldview. But it's a great thing that we are streaming on X. So you can always follow American Family Radio Network at AFRNet is the handle on social media. You can also follow American Family News, AFN. And there's some great content and articles and news from a Christian worldview perspective. Our great colleagues there do really excellent work. So if you have not been paying attention for the last probably 10 years-ish or so, this is Pride Month. So yet again, and for some reason, every June, we have to be completely inundated with the nauseating rainbow-colored everything that signals that people have so much pride in their genderless nonconformity alphabet letter soup nonsense. And, you know, it happens once a year, and it's once a month. But someone actually posted on X all of the different holidays, or and I don't know if you really call them holidays, probably not, because holiday stems from holy day, and this is anything but that, but at least maybe commemorations or, you know, little screaming fits, I don't know. But of all of the different days of the year that various groups from the Rainbow Mafia would like to suggest that we have to stop and observe. And it was everything from February through, like, mid-November. And I guess they take off a little bit of time for Christmas because probably maybe they believe in Santa Claus. I don't know. But there are so many different days. And actually, if you go to a calendar of observation days, I mean, there's everything now from, like, you know, National Puppy Day to National Ice Cream Cone Day, which I'm sure Joe Biden regularly celebrates almost every day. There's a bunch of different days. But Pride Month is a time specifically that we as Americans and even across Western civilization are inundated by this push and this intentional agenda for a commemoration of you must participate in our delusions is basically what the left is saying. And they have continued to do that agenda and have continued to push that agenda for decades, but especially with, and it's almost the 10-year anniversary that will be next year, the 10-year anniversary of the Obergefell versus Hodges decision. I can't believe it's already been 10 years, which was the U.S. Supreme Court opinion that legalized same-sex marriage. And we, as Christians, should always put same-sex in air quotes, because there is no such thing as a same-sex marriage, because God ordained the institution of marriage. And he said at the very beginning in Genesis 1 that he made them male and female. And for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, be united to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And then throughout Scripture, including in the New Testament, Jesus himself and also the apostles that specifically the Apostle Paul have always ratified the institution of marriage as God ordained it in Genesis. It has not changed, because God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so we have to take the full counsel of God and understand that even if there is no explicit renunciation or denunciation of every single gender that you can possibly identify with, according to the state of New York, in the New Testament by Jesus Christ himself, that does not mean that God affirmed homosexuality, that he affirmed the trans agenda, that he affirmed a homosexual lifestyle or gay marriage. It's just not true. And if you look at the Bible and you read it plainly without any confirmation bias agenda, you will reach the conclusion with the full counsel of God that God ordained marriage to be one man and one woman, that gender is immutable in the same way that age is. I can't change my age. I was born in 1984. That is by the sovereignty of God. That just is. And whether I like it or not, I am turning 40 in November. And that's just true. So that is okay. And we should all embrace the immutable characteristics that God ordained us as. And I'm also a woman, and God ordained that. And yes, we know what a woman is. And we can understand that God made us uniquely, and he made us with intention, and he did not make mistakes. And yet, according to CNN and the Rainbow Mafia yesterday, starting at the beginning of Pride Month, this is the headline. And you should never take parental advice from CNN or any of these experts, by the way, these so-called, and I put that in air quotes as well, because the experts would like to tell you as a parent what is best for your child, and say that instead of children being given to parents by God to raise in the fear and admonition of the Lord, we need to go to experts to tell us what our child's gender is, to tell us what our child's non-conforming status is, to tell us all of these things that we never knew, and therefore to abdicate them to the state experts, because in a globalist society that the left tries to ordain, and in their utopia, children belong to the state, and they are trying on purpose to raise literally a rainbow mafia of your children. So don't let it happen. But you have to be aware, and this is why I read CNN, Huffington Post, all of these other leftist outlets, because I want to see what they are saying to the rest of the population, and to compare and contrast that with truth. And now occasionally CNN can get it right? I mean, there are some times that they report facts. Shocking, I know, but sometimes they do. So it's not necessarily the outlet itself. It's the author sometimes. I have written opinion pieces in Newsweek. I have a very good friend who's on the program all the time, Josh Hamer, who is a senior editor at Newsweek, who is a very solid conservative. He's Jewish. He has some great perspectives, and he's in Newsweek. That's okay. So for all of these people who just say, you're believing Newsweek or you're believing CNN, that's not as important as what the actual article is arguing. And we have to be a little bit more sophisticated. And I think our AFR family, I respect so much our audience, because I think that you are deep thinkers and you like to analyze things. You don't just go with the party line or the really easy arguments against pros and cons just based on, you know, dismissing it based on the outlet. But generally speaking, we can read CNN with a lot of skepticism. And so this was the headline. If your kid just told you they're trans, here's what you should know. And this is by somebody named Kristen Rogers at CNN. Usually I like to read the bios, but I don't even have to in this case. And so it starts with Mary Hope Howland. This woman gave birth to a baby she thought was a boy. But at 6 years old, the child asked her questions such as, Mom, am I a boy? How do you know I'm a boy? Now, a regular parent who is wanting to tell their child the truth would say, well, son, we know that you are a boy based on your biology. Let me explain. And we would tell a child the truth because children, and I know this because my two nephews will be turning 6 years old in October. I just got to spend a couple of weeks with them when I was off on vacation a couple of weeks ago. They ask a lot of questions and a lot of very seemingly obvious questions. Why do children ask questions? Because they are curious about learning the truth of the world around them. And that's a very good thing. And we should always have that same curiosity, even as adults, to continue to learn about the reality to which God has presented us. And to approach things always wanting to know the truth. But this person, Mary Hope Holland, who is now the co-lead for this organization called Families United for Trans Rights, an organization of transgender kids and their loved ones, according to CNN, she says this in response to her six-year-old child saying, "Mom, am I a boy? How do you know I'm a boy?" "Once I clued in," she says, she said this to her child, "the doctors make a best guess based on your body. But only you can know, and we love you, no matter what." That's just false. So what happens if the child comes back to the mom and says, "Mom, how do you know that I'm human?" She's going to say, "Well, the doctors made their best guess based on your body, but only you can know. We love you no matter what. You may be a dinosaur. You may be a dog like Bluey." I mean, it's utterly absurd. And this is a parent that has an agenda that is manipulating that to their child and is refusing to tell this little boy the truth because the truth doesn't fit their agenda. And that in sum is what Pride Month is doing. And this article, which I just read with shock and awe, quite frankly, just going, this is just so far past even anything that we could have imagined even 10 years ago. I mean, I wrote in my book that was published in December of 2015, so right after or in the aftermath of the Obergefell versus Hodges decision, I said, you know, in a few decades, I think that we are going to see a lot more of the LGBTQ agenda. And you're hearing Copper in the background agreeing with me. He's being a good boy today. You can always follow them on Instagram, @2dudes_CopperandTodd. That you will see in the aftermath of that decision, it's not going to stop there. The left is never satisfied with any sort of win or bowing down to their agenda. They just have to take it further. And I said in that book almost 10 years ago, it'll be 10 years ago next December, that you're going to see an increasing embrace of even more deviant sexual behavior, even including things like pedophilia, bestiality, some of those things. Why? Because the left never stops. And in that moment, there were some critics, even among the conservatives, that said, okay, I mean, you know, we get that we still have to have the sanctity of marriage, you know, all that, which I think that the right and the conservative right completely failed on, by the way. That's a larger conversation for another day. But we couldn't possibly get to that level of depravity. Well, have you read history? Have you looked at the fall of Rome? Have you looked at other prior civilizations that once you take objective truth and moral truth that can only come from God himself out of society, what that looks like in that culture? Every single culture that has lost God has eventually gotten to the worst levels of depravity. And now here we are in Pride Month of 2024, with CNN openly saying that you should lie to your children and tell them that we don't know what their gender is based on their humanity and their innate immutable biology, and that we don't know, and only they can know based on their feelings, because we are that depraved as a society. So what is the Christian response to Pride Month? It is simply this: tell the truth without fear. Do not care if people call you a bigot, a hater, all of these other things. Is it more hateful? Ask them the question. Is it more hateful or more loving to simply tell the truth
Why would you lie to children? One of the most effective ways to shut down anyone hating on you like that for telling the truth, for standing the truth, for the truth, is to simply ask them questions. Reveal their inconsistencies of their worldview. But we have an opportunity, Christian, to stand firm in the truth and in the sanctity of God's morality and be good witnesses, contend for the faith each and every day during Pride Month. So that's my challenge to you this morning. Take every opportunity because the days are evil, as Ephesians 5 says. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Dr. Carl Truman, from the American Family Studios documentary, The God Who Speaks.
Typically, what sola scriptura, what scripture alone means for the reformers is this. We accept the church tradition as an authoritative statement of Christian faith and practice as long as it lines up with scripture. That's not the equivalent of the "it's just me and my Bible" attitude that we often find in evangelicalism today. It's we belong to a historic tradition, but we always need to check what the church is teaching in light of scripture. So scripture alone doesn't mean the only book I read is the Bible. Scripture alone means that the Bible is the ultimate principle by which everything the church ever says or does is to be checked.
Visit thegodwhospeaks.org.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And, you know, there's still a lot of fallout from the verdict of Donald Trump last week. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in the next segment. But the campaign goes on and we are, of course, rapidly headed toward November. And there is still a question out there about who Donald Trump, presuming that he is still the GOP nominee and nothing constitutionally will prevent him from that. And it doesn't look like the GOP is poised to reconsider or to have that conversation. And so it looks like Trump will be the nominee. So the question, of course, that we have continued to talk about is who will Donald Trump select as his VP? And occasionally I will read commentary, like I said in the last segment, that I read all across the spectrum, and I've read a lot of things about people's various opinions of who the VP will be, and my personal opinion, as regular listeners are aware of, is that we will not know until we know, because I'm having been in Trump world and knowing how Trump and makes his decisions, and it will just be his decision. He will ask literally everyone who works for him, people that don't, just friends, anybody whose opinion he wants, he will ask. But ultimately, it will be his decision, and everyone will be a contender until he selects that one person. But I ran across this piece in Town Hall from my good friend Kevin McCullough, who is an opinion contributor and is also a colleague on Salem Media. So he's on my Salem show frequently. And this piece was really interesting to me because Kevin gives an argument for a VP selection that I had not considered and I thought actually would be very worthwhile for Donald Trump to consider. So Kevin joins us this morning. And Kevin, I will not spoil the punchline. let's go through your analysis and good morning.
Good morning. Well, it's kind of interesting because I've been flushing this idea out for, 6 or 7 weeks in my head. And then I was on a date night with my bride on Friday, or on Saturday night, I guess. And we were at the Botanical Garden in the Bronx. And a good friend of ours, who used to be the press secretary for Mayor Giuliani when he was in office, was with us. And she said to me, did you know that there was a private dinner the night of the verdict last Thursday here in Manhattan? And I said, I had heard rumors of it. What was it about? And she said, well, evidently there were 9 significant people, titans of industry types, that he had pulled together, and he put forward the question exactly the way you described. Who do you think should be the VP? And a couple of people said Governor Burgum. Somebody said Tim Scott. But the consensus of the people in that room was that, Nikki Haley had all of these other voters that were out there. And if we really want to unify the base, maybe Nikki Haley was the one that should be gathered. And MAGA hates Nikki Haley for her betrayal to Trump in the "I promise I won't run for president." And then she ran for president. In fact, in a lot of ways, they dislike her more than like Mike Pence or some other people that they've soured on in recent months. But this it's interesting that Trump has not negatively associated Nikki with a nickname or anything since she got out of the race, from my perspective. And so this got me thinking, and I thought, nope, I've got to actually put this idea out there, because a number of months ago, Donald Trump said in a kind of an off the cuff remark, kind of an aside, he said, "I'd really like to change the map on Biden." And with him being in New York for the past 6 weeks, he held a big rally in the Bronx that was mind-boggling big. I mean, people showed up in numbers that nobody had suspected would. And he is polling extremely well with Latinos who are watching how he's being treated by the justice system that may have come from Cuba, that may have come from Venezuela, that may have come from other places where totalitarian powers exist. And they're saying, hey, I see what's happening to him. That's just like what happened to us. That's why we left. So there's all these kind of, you know, alter inertia kind of side movements that are going on around this. And I got to thinking, you know, in 2020, Donald Trump lost New York by about 23%. But 1 year later, just 1 year to the day, Lee Zeldin lost the race for governor by about 3%. And it was a really tight race that came down to basically, had he flipped one borough in the New York City area besides Staten Island, if he had been able to add, say, a Bronx to that total, he probably would have won. But if you look at the maps between the counties when Trump lost and the counties when Zeldin lost, Zeldin flipped many of the counties that Trump had difficulty carrying. So my crazy idea, Jenna, long story short, you don't need a ticket mate to balance Trump out. People are not going to vote for Donald Trump because Nikki Haley is there. You don't need someone that's going to pull what I think are suspicious Nikki Haley voters into the crowd. I think a lot of the people that voted for her, particularly in New Hampshire and places where open primaries were Democrats who were kind of going, well, we got Biden. That's who ours is going to be. So we're going to get Trump and try to take him out in the primary. I don't know that any of those people come back to Trump in the general election. And Trump is doing a good job of expanding his base with African Americans and Latinos and other groups all on his own. He's increasing in those demographics. So what does he really need from a running mate? What if, and it's a crazy idea, what if he named Zeldin as his running mate and he said, Lee, all I want you to do is reconfigure that organization that you had in 21 and go to every county and just campaign 24/7. New York's economy is worse than it's ever been. There's a lot of problems that the people in this state are very frustrated with. Make the case that America First principles, like you did when you ran for governor, would be the solution, and see if we can't flip New York. Usually, Jenna, and you know this, Democrats are given California and New York out of the starting gate. Republicans get Texas and Florida, and then the chess game is filling in all the rest of the pieces. If Trump were to steal New York early on election night, it would radically change the shape of the entire race in ways that I don't think the Democrats would be ready to respond to. You can't cheat enough to overcome the loss of New York in the Electoral College. Now, does he have to win? No. All he has to do is keep the polling, which is right now, and you were talking about the verdict, he was at 23% in 2020. 3 weeks ago, he was at 9% in New York State. After the verdict, there was an Emerson poll that came out showing him at 7, but if you figure margin of error, he could be as close as 3. It is tighter than anybody would have ever forecasted in New York State. Could Lee Zeldin, with a popular message, clean cut, he's a reservist, he's married to a Latina, he speaks fluent Spanish. Hey, there's an idea. How about GOP candidates putting Spanish ads on in their own language in, you know, markets across the country? But could he narrow the gap close enough to just make them have to spend a lot of money in the New York media market and therefore drain funds from Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and all the rest. I think it would be an interesting strategy, and it certainly sounds like something Donald Trump would try to do.
And I'm speaking with Kevin McCullough, who wrote this great piece in Town Hall that I would encourage listeners to read. And it's titled "The Trump VP Will Be ... which we're all waiting for. And Kevin, I really like this analysis because this is playing opposition. And this is not just playing defense. You know, this is going on the offensive. And the GOP historically has not done that well at all. And Donald Trump, the reason that he was very loved in 2016 and throughout his four-year administration is because he did non-conventional, out-of-the-box things like this to put the Democrats and the leftists kind of on their heels and to push forward a conservative agenda instead of just being so reactive. And I agree mm-hmm. with you completely that, you know, Trump's personality is what it is. I mean, people either love him or hate him. There is, like, nobody can just be on the fence with Trump. That is one of, you know, love him or hate him. That's actually one of, I think, his better qualities is that he takes people off the fence and you kind of have to stand and declare, what do you think about policy? What do you think about all of these issues? So nobody, I mean, he could get he could get Ben Carson in there, for example, and that's not going to change what people think about Trump. This, you know, very
correct,
conservative, mild-mannered kind of person as his VP. Doesn't matter. People are not going to change their opinion on Trump based on the VP. The only thing I think is if he went totally out of the box and picked someone that was, say, you know, a complete advocate for partial birth abortion, or, you know, something that goes to the essence of a very critical issue for a huge segment of the voting bloc, like evangelicals, like people who listen to AFR, for example, that may concern us and that may change our opinion overall, but not as to Donald Trump in particular. So the reason that I like this argument is because it does play into a better strategy. And it also is going along, I think, with what a lot of us, former Trumpers like me, you know, former in the sense that I don't work for him anymore, and people even in Trump world now that want him to select someone who is going to be advantageous to a critical voting bloc. And I think it's not so much the voting bloc as it is the campaign funds, because that has been the left's intent with all of these indictments, all of this lawfare, everything that's gone on in New York that was predicted from a year ago, was to simply drain campaign funds and to focus the attention of conservatives on that battle instead of simply saying, we don't care, let's go and make you all focus on a different battle. So how, you know, how likely is it in your view, knowing the players now in Trump world versus 2016, 2020, and so forth, that, you know, some of these things will actually be considered and maybe tossed around? I mean, I hope that, and I think that Trump is going to ask everybody under the sun, and I hope that this op-ed makes its way to his desk for consideration.
Well, I hope it does too, and I think there's probably a pretty good chance that it will. It's kind of a fun thing to every now and then get a signed copy of my own column returned to me in the mail with his signature on it. But I don't.
He's great about those.
It doesn't
things happen
very often, so when it does, it's kind of fun. But I think that what is, you said something at the beginning there, that this is going on offense, and I think that Trump has always been one who would prefer to be, you know, advancing as opposed to trying to defend the advance of the other side. And the media tends to think very monolithically, and everybody tends to think very traditionally in terms of how the map is going to be laid out. That's why there's such an argument over swing states. But you know what happens if Trump steals New York early on election night? He can lose almost all of the swing states and carry the nomination if he keeps Texas and Florida. Like, that's what a big opposite swing this is. So what if he takes New York and the swing states, where he has leads much bigger in this year than he didn't even have the lead in many of the states at this time in 2020. It was like a 1-2% difference, and usually Biden was ahead, but, you know, if you figured the weighting of the poll, maybe they were in a dead heat, etc. if he does something big and bold like this, again, not even having to win, just keep the polling close all the way up through Election Day, then Biden has to drain his resources from the Midwest. He's got to put it in the most expensive media market that there is, and he's got to spend a lot of money just to keep home plate on his side of the equation. I think it's I don't know if he'll do it. As you said, nobody can read the mind of Trump. He likes to get a really broad swath of opinions, and then he usually narrows in on something that's very unique and very, you know, he sees something that not everybody else does. But I think that this is worth considering because we need to be thinking this way if we're really going to change the country. We've got to go out and find the people that are hurting the most. You said something about personality. Personality, I don't care about the personality. I don't want to pay $10 for a carton of eggs anymore. I want to be paying $4 for that carton of eggs. And right. that's the real, you know, problem that people in, at least in the New England and, you know, this part of the country are dealing with.
Yeah, and I'm speaking with Kevin McCullough, and his op-ed in Town Hall is the Trump VP will be ... go read it in townhall.com. And it's absolutely true, and I've been saying for a year now that that Trump needs to focus his messaging more on the economy, on the border, on Israel, on all of these things other than what the Democrats would love him to focus on, which is the lawfare. I mean, some people, you know, want to focus on that, and obviously we need to talk about that, but he needs to go and actually show what the economy looks like now under Biden versus what it looked like under him. And nobody can actually argue that. And I hope that the debate coming up will we will focus more on that than just Biden hammering, well, you're a convicted felon, which we know he will. And it, you know, and hopefully Trump will have some very choice responses to that. But I think you're absolutely right as well, Kevin, that if we look at the electoral map for the future of conservatism, we have to look and take a page from the leftist's own playbook. I mean, they're coming after the state of Texas. They were coming after Florida. Thank goodness Governor DeSantis was elected here in my home state, you know, back in 2018. Otherwise, we might have lost Florida. But they are trying to target red state battlegrounds. We need to go on the offense and target conservative, target as conservatives, the blue states, and take some of their just obvious say, you know, some of their obvious states away from them. So in just the last minute or so, so what would your advice to the campaign be heading into the debate when Biden says convicted felon?
Yeah, I think that as best as I would like him to just ignore it and just put the shine, put the light back on. Well, it's easy for you to say that, Joe, but you've bankrupted half of the country. You've got, you say you're up in jobs numbers, but that's because the average person's working three jobs now as opposed to the one job they were working under my administration. And you've made us less safe. You've starved us of energy. We don't have the resources to even protect ourselves. You've put our nation at risk. You have made us vulnerable. That's what I want to hear him say over and over and over again. That's why people turned out in the Bronx, by the way. They don't want to pay $16 for a gallon of milk. They want to be able to afford their bus pass at the end of the week. It's a tough, tough world.
Yeah, really well said. Well, Kevin McCullough, appreciate your time. You can follow him at That Kevin Show on social media. Read him in townhall.com. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show, and that's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you, we need to save them. That's why we've partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears that heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies. And that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or $140, helps to rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just dial pound 250 on your cell and say the keyword baby.
That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And we were talking in the last segment about a potential way of sort of flipping the script on the leftists in the upcoming election, and with Trump likely being the GOP nominee. I don't see that changing really heading into November. And the conservatives really as a whole need to do better at being on the offensive instead of just playing defense. And so, for example, when I was representing John MacArthur and Grace Community Church, along with my colleagues from the Thomas More Society, the main reason that we ended up being able to settle that case with an almost $1 million settlement from LA County and Gavin Newsom, which was just great, by the way, I mean, for their absolutely absurd, arcane, and utterly ridiculous COVID restrictions that targeted churches. The only reason that that I'm convinced that we ended up with that outcome is because we actually went on the offensive in that case as well and sued Gavin Newsom and LA County and forced them to prove that, which of course they couldn't, and that's why they settled, to prove that their COVID restrictions were constitutional, because you can't be held in violation of an unconstitutional mandate to begin with. And so the right needs to do more of that. The American Family Association is doing a lot of that in terms of the legislation, the AFA Action is putting forward, some of these other lawsuits, and our good friend Abraham Hamilton III, the host of the Hamilton Corner right here on AFR, has just great commentary about a lot of these things. And the right, conservatives in general, needs to do more of that. So in the wake of the verdict last week with Donald Trump, that wasn't surprising, but was nonetheless incredibly disheartening, I know, to a lot of people, you know, myself included, just to see that the system on all points has failed. I mean, you would think that a jury of his peers, somebody on that jury, would look at this with a little bit more skepticism than, you know, 2 days of deliberation and guilty on all 34 counts. But the question is, you know, where legally potentially could we go from here? We know that Trump's lawyers intend to appeal this. Sentencing will be July 11th, just days before the Republican National Convention is poised currently to be held. There are some suggestions and calls for them to move that up to maybe Independence Day on July 4th. I don't think it really matters personally, but it is what it is. And are there ways that we could go on the offensive? Well, our good friend Vivek Ramaswamy, who is a regular guest on this show, has said, including in an op-ed actually last year when this first came out, and this is in the Wall Street Journal, this was back April 5th of 2023, says the president, whoever that may be, because obviously that wouldn't be Joe Biden, but the president can pardon Trump. There's ample case law suggesting a state can't penalize a defendant for a forgiven federal crime. So joining me now to discuss this novel and untested but nonetheless interesting legal theory is our good friend Mike Donnelly, who is an attorney and a law professor. And so, Mike, you and I had actually discussed this last week in kind of the wake or leading up to the verdict. And you had suggested that this may be a possibility. Kind of lay out this potential theory.
Well, Jen, it's good to talk with you, and good morning. And wow, we are on June 3rd, Monday. A president of the United States has been convicted of 34 felonies in New York State. We are in uncharted territory in this country. I sure hope that the appeals judges will reconsider this and do justice when they have the opportunity to do so. In terms of the theory of a pardon, look, the underlying crime that we have now figured out weeks and weeks after the trial even started is this alleged federal election offense, which the Federal Election Commission declined to prosecute, said there was not even a civil fine associated with it. And this is what Alvin Bragg used to try to get a felony conviction. You know, if you listen to some of the highly respected legal commentators that I've been listening to, Jonathan Turley and John Yu, who are commenting on this. You know, as somebody who's watching this a little bit less day-to-day than those guys are, I was trying to figure out, what is the underlying offense here? And they confirmed, as other people have confirmed, they don't even know. How can you convict someone of a felony and when the underlying element of that felony is that the misdemeanor was in furtherance of a crime, and you haven't a crime. You don't even allege a crime until the jury instructions. And then the judge, Judge Merchant, says, well, it doesn't really matter, you know, on what basis you find that he did something unlawfully. You don't have to be unanimous. There are so many avenues of appeal here and reversible error that the hope, I hope, as some of these other fellows hope, is this will get dealt with quickly. So in terms of the federal crime, though, if the president I think the governor of New York might be able to get involved here. But I mean, how can you see Joe Biden or Catherine Hochul even getting involved here? It just doesn't make any sense. But if the federal offense were pardoned, then the conviction for the felony would basically go away because the Supreme Court has held numerous times that you can't prosecute someone in state court under a federal crime.
And so that's really a fascinating issue because so many people are suggesting, Mike Donnelly, that because this is only state level, I mean, it was brought in the state of New York and all that, that you would have to use the pardon process under the state of New York rules. And, you know, usually that's always the governor. And in this case, New York's process, it would be Governor Hochul, who is unlikely to do that, even though there are some Democrats calling on her and also Biden to get involved for sake of the country. I think they're right about that. And, you know, if we look back at American history's precedent and how Gerald Ford pardoned Nixon, just for sake of the country to move on. We did move on as a country, and it would be a good thing here. But there is because we are so quick in time for November, that's coming up so soon. Is it more likely that Trump would be elected and be able to pardon himself after taking office on, you know, January 20th of 2025, then a court of appeals or the U.S. Supreme Court could hear an appeal and render, you know, or overturn the verdict out of New York?
Great question. I think the Supreme Court of the United States could get this case quickly if Trump's lawyers wanted to try to elevate it there on the underlying federal election alleged crime. It would, you know, they have to seek expedited review through the New York Court of Appeals, the appellate division, and then to the Court of Appeals, and then they would have to get up to the Supreme Court. It would seem to me that they have a very strong argument for an expedited appeal. You know, we are talking about a presidential election. One would hope that the appellate division and the Court of Appeals judges would take this quickly, and even if they're going to find against Trump, at least give the Supreme Court of the United States an opportunity to convene and you know, pronounce on the federal election, the alleged federal election crime. And then it goes back and now you have a completely different situation. You have potentially a misdemeanor, or then maybe you've even got to order a new trial on the misdemeanor. Maybe Alvin Bragg decides, okay, well, maybe this goes away. I don't know what he would decide, but I think it could go to the Supreme Court quickly. I mean, the other idea that Donald Trump is elected in November and pardons himself certainly could happen. Posted on some of my social accounts, I said that the real verdict will come in on November 5th when the American people vote. And if we have Donald Trump as president, then the people have spoken.
Yeah, and they don't care about all of the lawfare if that happens. And we'll see. I mean, I think it'll boil down to whether the independents, the moderates, if there really are, you know, that big of a block of undecided voters left in the country, you know, what their view is on this, because obviously we have the Trump haters, the Trump lovers, and that's basically what you have going into November. And then also, you know, those who hate Biden and his policies, but I think even the love or hate of Trump is probably even stronger. But the question about the Supreme Court is interesting, though, because, you know, they traditionally go on their break at the end of June and don't reconvene until October. Has there been any precedent for something like this that they could maybe hold a special session in, say, August or September to deal with this question? Or are we going to have to wait until October, potentially?
I don't think there's any reason why the court could not convene. I'm not aware of it doing so over the summer. But look, this is the first time in history this has ever happened. And it's just, this is just one case, right? So, and I love what you said about, you know, on the offense, and maybe we'll have a moment or two to talk about that, because I think that's right. I mean, there's nothing better than a good offense to help your defense. As a soccer coach, I love to see the ball on the other side of the field when my team is playing. Not on their side, but on the other team's side. Keep it down there so they can't score, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't see any reason why the Supreme Court couldn't reconvene. I think they would. I think they would have to. I don't see how the Supreme Court sits on the sideline and doesn't convene to have a special session if they need to hear an appeal if it can be gotten quickly through the Court of Appeal system in New York.
And hopefully the Supreme Court would see the urgency, because traditionally, while a lot of the cases that go up in front of them have major national impact, it's not necessarily urgent in the sense that we're talking about a November presidential election deadline. So that would make sense, and hopefully a Chief Justice Roberts would see it that way. But let's talk about going on the offensive for the last about 5 minutes that we have here with you. Mike Donnelly, you can follow him at Donnelly Speaks on X. He also has other social media accounts and posts things almost as snarky as me, so always appreciate that. And Mike, it's true, and you and I have talked for years, you know, about this.
Almost.
Well, thank you for that. I do wear my tiara proudly, so I did say almost, but you're getting there. So, you know, soon. But, you know, we've talked about this for years, how, you know, even in the context of what I was talking about at the beginning of the segment with Pride Month, and how, you know, the left is constantly just pushing their agenda through legislative lawfare and through jurisprudential lawfare. I mean, they just continue to try to make the conservatives be on the defensive, and we need to go on offensive. I mean, that was one of the great things about the 303 Creative case, for example, that the Alliance Defending Freedom filed, that was a pre-enforcement challenge that said, we don't want to wait and be defending this. And they won a great victory at the Supreme Court for religious liberty and for the First Amendment, for freedom of speech. And I think we need to do more of that. What issues do you see, and ways that conservatives, not just Republicans, but conservatives, could do that better?
Well, I think it's true. Conservatives are so busy trying to obey the law and support the rule of law that, you know, we don't think of doing these kinds of crazy things that Alvin Bragg and other people are doing. You know, and honestly, I think that's a good thing. I mean, we need to uphold the rule of law. We need to stand for the rule of law. It just bothers me so much to see what the left is doing just to advance their political interests. And it's like what happened in the Senate when Harry Reid, you know, got rid of the filibuster for appeals court judges. And Mitch McConnell said, you were probably going to regret this. And now we have Neil Gorsuch, you know, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court, which would have been difficult to do under the circumstances, but for that, right? So, when you talk about going on the offense, so I think Donald Trump has an opportunity here. I don't know if any of his legal team listen to your show, but if they do, I'm not giving them legal advice here, but I do want to point out 42 U.S.C. 1983, 1985, and 1986, which are civil rights statutes, federal civil rights statutes, which prohibit any person under color of law, including judges and prosecutors, from depriving a person or conspiring to deprive a person of their constitutional rights, privileges, or immunities under the federal constitution. This is a civil prosecution. Now, it's not a prosecution. It's a civil lawsuit that Donald Trump could file against Alvin Bragg, Judge Merchan, Jack Smith, possibly Fannie Willis. You know, these are prosecutors. They are judges. These are officials who are using the law to deprive him of his federal constitutional right to run for president and to have due process, I would argue. And I think there's probably some other things we can try to be creative. But, you know, when you're going on the attack and you're going after your opponent, they are now unbalanced. And so I think, you know, there's an element here of what you're saying, Republicans, conservatives, and Donald Trump. If we're pushing back against this kind of lawfare, this unprecedented lawfare, this politically motivated lawfare, then maybe they will think twice about engaging in it in the future.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that that really has to be the solution to all of this lawfare, because if we are constantly defending, we will only lose ground. I mean, that is just the nature of war, whatever, you know, and the two ideologies that underpin the two major parties, that is the war. I mean, it is a war for America's future, what that looks like. And it's a different type of war than, you know, hopefully we don't actually have a literal armed civil war again in this country, but it is an ideological battleground. And if we are just defending instead of going on the offense, we will only continue to lose ground. So we have to do this and more of the ideas that you are talking about, Mike Donnelly. And there's so much more we could discuss, but that's why I'm on each and every morning, Monday through Friday, here on the American Family Radio Network. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Thanks so much to Mike Donnelly, and I will see you tomorrow morning.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.